Good evening, everyone. Very warm evening. Thank you for making it through the soupy air of Melbourne this evening to this second edition of Question Time, a new series from the Wheeler Centre. Today, as you are all very aware, we're talking about jobs of the future, something that I'm sure that we all think a lot about. I know that I certainly do. I'm a reporter for the ABC, so particularly in this climate, I think a lot about my job and whether I'm going to have a job this time next month, let alone this time in 5 years. I also spend a lot of time reporting on things like the demise of manufacturing, but we don't necessarily always think about what's coming in the future. We talk about what's finishing, but not necessarily what's coming in the future. And so this is a really critical question, I think, for us as a society to answer. And there are a few really important things which I hope that we get onto tonight. What will the jobs of the future be? Is it going to be possible? Are there going to be enough jobs for our children to fulfil? As a mum of a three-year-old, I worry a lot about that. And how can Australia keep jobs which increasingly seem to be going overseas? What are we going to do? How are we going to earn our crust? And we've got a really very diverse and very interesting panel here this evening for you. Now, I'll get them to introduce themselves in a minute, but just a reminder that this is a Q&A. This is your question time. It's not me asking them questions. It's meant to be you asking them questions. All right, so Peter, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure,
first?
Thank you. My name's Peter Gain. I'm a professor at the University of Melbourne and director of the Centre for Workplace Leadership. So the centre is concerned, obviously, about...
Peter, maybe, sorry, just to interrupt, just bring your mic a little closer.
So, among other things, the centre is concerned with the whole question of what the future of work looks like. And we've got a program of research that is investigating the future of work.
My name's Matt Wicking. I'm here in my capacity as Greenie in Residence at Arts House, the City of Melbourne, which is a role that certainly didn't exist just a few years ago. I'm also a sustainability consultant and a facilitator for the Centre of Sustainability Leadership, where I help train future leaders and people who are going to be doing the jobs of the future.
I'm Jill Palmer. I'm currently Vice-Chancellor at RMIT. RMIT has got 82,000 students. As a university, it's been educating people for work. As the old Working Men's College, that was its original title. We now have, as I say, 82,000 students in Australia and overseas, largely interested in jobs.
Producing people who will have jobs at the end.
Exactly. Education, of course. I'm not saying that they're not intellectually stimulating, fantastic students, but really we're a vocational university. We're there because of the idea that we educate across the range from certificates right the way through to PhDs, people who are probably looking for work, jobs. And you're going to say that work isn't jobs, aren't you? Jobs isn't work. Go on.
No, I'm probably going to say that, I suspect. My name's Charles Brass. I'm a practicing futurist, which means I work with organisations and individuals who want to better engage with the future. And I joined this discussion about 20 years ago when we created a thing called the Future of Work Foundation, which was all about the future of work and not about the future of jobs. So I'm the one who's going to make that distinction this evening.
So already this evening on the panel we have two people whose jobs didn't exist a little while ago. So we've got a futurist and we've got a greenie in residence. So Matt, why don't you've probably got the most interesting job title. So tell us what your job didn't exist 10, 15 years ago and you probably came out of university not that much longer before that. So let's just start off with you and tell us initially about how your job first evolved and what your job, the existence of your job, says about jobs of the future.
So, yeah, you're right. I do have a really cool job title. I quite like being able to tell people I'm Greenie in Residence. It's one of the many hats that I wear. But each of the hats that I wear didn't exist 10, 15 years ago. And I've been in roles where I'm the consultant trying to bring the future into the room. Of an organisation. That's what I see as a sustainability role as. It's helping an organisation to look long-term. And in economies like the one that we're all a part of, where we have short-term reporting to shareholders and short-term profit goals and short-term strategic plans as well, that's an increasingly important role, I think. I found my way into it after I was looking for something that was attached my passions with my job. I think that's something that people are increasingly looking for, and something that had broader meaning to it, that wasn't just a paycheck. In fact, if I wanted a paycheck, this is not necessarily the field to go into if I wanted a big paycheck. But yeah, something that had that broader meaning, that's really important to me.
I'm sure that you've got a lot to say about many things that Matt's just said then, Charles.
Yeah, well, futurists, the phrase futurist has been around actually for about 40 or 50 years, but not in this country. And essentially, it's arisen as people have started asking themselves questions about what has happened as the future has arrived. And they've been surprised or angered or upset or in some way disturbed, perturbated by the future. And they've said, gee, is there something we could do about that? And in this country for the last 10 years, you've been able to go to Swinburne University and get a master's degree in what's called strategic foresight, which is an attempt to try and systematise that approach to attempting to understand the future.
So both of your jobs, they deal with ideas. They don't deal with things. And traditionally, for a large part of the last century, jobs were about things, weren't they? And that's not the case anymore. And if we're not... Are there enough jobs for all of us to be greenies in residence or to be futurists or, you know, are there enough jobs where people think about stuff rather than actually make stuff?
The Australian futurist business consultant Phil Riven has a way of portraying this. He talks about there being three great revolutions. In the agrarian revolution, he says, all these revolutions have changed the way jobs and work arise, because what we've done is human beings have outsourced things they once did for themselves. So in the agrarian revolution 10,000 years ago, we outsourced the growing of things. Once upon a time, it was a small domestic enterprise. We outsourced the growing. In the industrial revolution, we outsourced the making of things. And he says in the current infotronic revolution, we're outsourcing the doing of things. And so Phil's idea is that there still is a whole raft of human activity that we do for ourselves, and this is capable of being outsourced, and while that's capable of being outsourced, there's the possibility of the economy continuing to expand and grow, and that's what he sees as a good outcome.
Is there an end point to that, though?
Well, I've been on stage with Phil a couple of times, and I have said, thanks, Phil, but I'd like to wipe my own bum, if you don't mind. So I wonder where that stops. And I seriously... there's a second reason, not just the humorous bit about what I actually want to do for myself, but the second reason that I worry about that is that it's not only that human beings are now capable of outsourcing all this stuff, we're capable of outsourcing it to non-human beings. We now have the capacity to get technology to do a whole lot of this stuff that we once did for ourselves. And that's fine in theory, but it does raise the question, what are people going to do, first of all, and then how are people going to gather together the money necessary to participate in the economy? That, I think, is the big challenge.
I just had a thought about your initial question, which is about the ideas rather than things and work being around each of those. My job is primarily or firstly about ideas, yes, but I work with people who are in all sorts of industries. So I'm working with people who run fertilizer companies, to people who are artists creating things out there in the world, to engineers, to you name it. And my people in my sector often joke about our role as basically to be to put ourselves out of a job. Ideally, this would be something that you don't need a greenie in residence because everyone's doing this stuff. You don't need a sustainability consultant or a futurist because this is part of what we do, or how we do what we do, rather. And whether that's ideas or things, right across the board.
But, Peter, when we were talking earlier, and please do put your hand up if you want to make a comment or if you want to ask a question, you seem to be a little bit more philosophical about this.
Well, I was thinking about sort of why are jobs of the future changing? And I suppose fundamentally it's about the fact that all economies that are dynamic in nature have job destruction and creation. It's the eternal process, almost, of the way that economies begin to innovate, to grow, expand and adapt, if you like, to changing circumstances. So I think it's always a part of the way that economies grow and develop. You know, I have some concerns along the lines that Charles shared. But I suppose I'm also reminded of some of the discussions in the 70s and 80s when we thought we were going to have a problem because we had too much leisure time. I don't know about you, but I need leisure time. Mm. That's it.
I don't have enough. That's my problem. My God, exactly. I work all the bloody time.
So it hasn't quite sort of panned out that way. And one can have a sense in which, I suppose, we can over-catastrophise the future and the way that technology might work. Having said that, we know from data over the last 20 years that there has been a shift in the way that technology is impacting on the nature of jobs. So up until the 1980s, we pretty much saw jobs that were being destroyed were largely lower-skilled jobs, and the ones that were being created were higher-skilled jobs. But really, since the mid to late 1980s, we've seen that balance shift such that, really over the last decade now, we're seeing more high-skilled jobs being destroyed and being created by lower-skilled jobs. So we're getting...
Can you give us some examples of...
So think about people who might sort of work in a law firm. So think about document search, which would have been done by paralegals and young lawyers starting out in the profession. A lot of that's now mechanised. It's done by sort of computers. You've got sort of a whole range of technologies that support that. So that would be sort of one example of where that is the case. I remember going to the Ford plant out at Broadmeadows, again, in the early 1990s, and I can't remember exactly how many workers were there, but there were about 1,000, and they were beginning to introduce automated sort of processes. And then I remember visiting that in 2011 and to see just the rate at which, in that case, manufacturing jobs had been substituted by automatic and robotic processes was quite incredible. So we're seeing it across the board in a whole range of both service and production jobs.
But what lower-skilled jobs are actually being created? Because I don't see that.
Okay, well, one particular... And I suppose it gets round to what are the big drivers, if you like, of new products and services. So obviously tastes are changing. We've shifted in terms of our discretionary expenditure away from just buying stuff to buying services. So a lot of services are personal services. So they occur through interpersonal interaction. And we know that a lot of these jobs tend to be semi-skilled jobs. So we're seeing a lot of the personal jobs in sort of health and personal services. They're very mixed, but a lot more jobs being created in those sectors which are lower-skilled jobs. If we look at projections, for instance, I mentioned the legal profession. Most of the job growth in the legal profession is expected to be at the lower end, again, because we're seeing automation of those types of processes. So it is sort of happening across the board.
Mm-hmm. We had a question over there. Letitia?
Thank you. My question was initially directed to Matt, but I'd love everyone on the panel to comment on it. Matt, I'm assuming that when you were in university, you didn't know that your current job existed. So I'd say that's probably true for all these jobs that are being created in the future. How would a young person prepare for these jobs when they don't know what they look like? So in university,
that's a very
degree?
Pointed question for Jill, I think, as well. So maybe, Matt, you have a go and then Jill can have
a
crack.
Well, I was going to ask, Matt, what did you do at university? Because that's quite interesting. And was it useful or have you had to completely reskill? And then I'll answer it as well.
All right. So I'll answer this first and then that. Yeah. I thought that I was just a young guy that didn't know what I wanted to do, but it turns out my job just hadn't been created yet. I did a psychology degree when I was younger, and then I did a commerce degree, or I did the two at the same time, and I've since done a Master's of Environmental Studies. So the Master's obviously came about, but I did uni for 6 years before I got to the point of realising that there's this emerging, burgeoning space called environmental studies, and that it's actually a really broad field and it incorporates the other stuff that I've studied, but it's more than that. Your question in terms of how do you prepare for jobs that haven't even been created yet or don't exist, I think it's a really great question. And the same question goes for organisations. How do they function in a way that prepares for the future when we don't know what that's going to be? So this is really a question about operating in uncertainty. I think we're always operating in uncertainty. It's just whether we acknowledge it or not. And so if you're acknowledging it, I think that's a very good first step to realise. And then I think that there are skills and tools that we could be equipping people with at university that would stand them in good stead for any sort of future. So, I mean, I'm sure Charles will say that any good futures thinking is not about predicting the future, but about thinking about what possible futures exist and how you might prepare for that. Skills like systems thinking, critical thinking, reflective thinking.
What does that even mean?
Which one?
All of them.
All right.
And how can anyone prepare?
I didn't want to go on
for
too long, but I still won't. So, yes, systems thinking is about understanding the thing you're doing in any moment and how that relates to the broader context. Most of us function in our day-to-day lives as if the human population is not destroying the biosphere at a rapid and increasing rate. That doesn't make sense. It's not sustainable on any measure, and it's problematic. Systems thinking would mean that you would reflect on that and then bring it into your practice, and it's a continual ongoing process. Transdisciplinarity, or thinking across or between disciplines, not in silos, is another way of approaching an uncertain future. So working with others, collaborating, not doing it yourself.
So that's the theory.
Yep.
Jill, you can maybe tell us about the practice.
It's a good question and a good answer. I mean, education institutions, I think, have always, to some extent, trained people for jobs that didn't exist. The difference now is that it's much bigger as a feature. So the third industrial revolution that we've been talking about is clearly rather different from some of the ones we've had before. And the predictability of what one once was able to do isn't there. So MIT, for example, has been teaching engineers for years and years and years in auto and in aerospace. We educate apparently half of the engineers in Victoria, and now we look at a future where we've got to think what happens next. Yeah? Huge changes, quite dramatic changes. In terms of education for an unpredictable future, I think universities have always done that to some extent, in that an education that actually does make you think about things, think about the future, the long-term futures, think about how your discipline area or your interest is affected by other changes is always going to be useful. And what we've got to do is realise the importance of some of the things you're saying, that it's not necessarily so job-focused in a particular job as it used to be, which means we've got to teach people to be more mobile, more flexible, realising that the particular skills they have at the moment might not last that long, they're going to have to constantly retrain. All of this is being discussed at the moment, of course, because job career prospects, especially in Victoria at the moment, are quite an issue.
Does that mean, though, that you need to have a foundation in a certain skill, though? Would that be ultimately the...
It used to be in greats, didn't it? Philosophy at Oxford and Cambridge. It probably worked quite well, actually.
That's right.
Something that
we might go
really
back to that.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you need increasingly, and I think it's the way we're shifting undergraduate education in particular, you need two things. One is some type of, if you like, sort of technical sort of base, but you also need a broader set of skills. And one is about understanding, and it reflects systems thinking, understanding the broader world in which you're expected to operate. So the new Melbourne model degrees are really about giving students that type of breadth as well as a particular technical area of expertise. So you need that. You also need problem solving because, again, as you look at the labour market, one thing that is happening is that people are churning more quickly through different states in the labour market, through different labour market transitions. So they have to negotiate their way through it. They have to retrain. They have to be prepared to sort of shift, if you like, their identity around particular jobs, occupations, professions. And it requires people, again, to have that reflective thinking skills, problem solving, all of those types of things. So they're increasingly embedded into the way that we teach undergraduates in particular.
Can I just add that education at university level used to be a very small proportion of the population. It's now much bigger, which is one of the problems with public funding, etc. But in the future world where we're more uncertain what happens, I think the need for education for everybody is very important. And then we've got the problem, are the jobs going to actually distribute the income around so that everybody has a good society? Or are we going to get more and more segregation in society between the rich and the poor? That's an issue. That's an issue. Mm. But if you can educate people, one would hope that things might get better.
I'd agree with all of those things. I think resilience is a word that's often used and to do with uncertainty. The way that I would put it is this.
Can I just say about resilience? Yep. My daughter's daycare the other day. She's three. They said she's doing very well in all of her milestones, but she needs to be more resilient. So we're teaching her resilience very, very early in the piece.
It's a very interesting concept. But for me, the big change that's happened is in the way we think about jobs. When I entered the job market, basically what you did, I'm a boy, so what boys did was they decided about year nine whether they worked with their hands or their brains, and then they got themselves either into a trade or a profession. And then it was up to their trade or their profession or their employer to provide them with a job. If you worked for Meyer when I first started work in the 1960s, it was Meyer's responsibility to keep you busy between 9 and 5, Monday to Friday. Now, if there's no work in Meyer at some time, they send you home, don't pay you. So the responsibility has shifted from being the employer's responsibility to provide a job. It is now your responsibility to find the work that you need. And that's where all of this discussion that we've just had comes in. And that's the real shift that we need to get through people's heads. Whatever you're doing, whether it's education, whether you're at school, whether you're at university, you are acquiring a set of skills. Yes, you are, but the real question is, how are you approaching the world? Because it is now your responsibility. For better or worse, it's up to you, not up to your employer or your profession.
Does that give you any comfort in answer to your question? Can we get a mic over there, please, to the lady who asked the question in the first place?
I wouldn't say it gives me comfort, but it's... I think it might have been Jill, you mentioned that ambiguity and change is just a part of life, and just, you know, I don't know, 50 years ago there might have been other ambiguity that we had to deal with, so it's just about, I guess, being open to it.
Are you a uni?
No, I'm not.
No, you're not.
No. Yeah. So I've already done my degree, chosen my path, but even though I'm 10 years into the workforce, I see that future landscape of my career is very ambiguous, that what used to be maybe three different jobs is now 50 different jobs that I could do at home, at the cafe, at an office. So there's just a lot of ambiguity, and it's about, like, I think last gen one, I'm sorry, I didn't remember your name.
Charles,
you made a really good point about we're in charge. I kind of never really considered it from that perspective, but you're absolutely right. It's my responsibility now to create my own career and educate myself.
Which is exciting and nerve-wracking in equal measure, maybe.
Yes, and exciting.
Yeah. I brought my bag up to the stage because I've been dealing with this for 20 years. I have in my bag a few copies of a book which was published in the mid-90s and you can't get it anymore. But it's the best book I've ever seen. It's called Making Your Future Work, written by an Australian called Marcus Letcher. And the idea, it builds on a phrase that was first coined by Charles Handy. Charles Handy talked about creating a portfolio life. In his book, Marcus Letcher calls it a modular life. But the concept of making your future work is about seeing the whole of your life as a tapestry that you're creating. Whereas once upon a time, that thing called the job was created for you by somebody else. And you went to it, and the theory was you got enough money out of it to go and make the rest of your life work. Now you're responsible for all of it. And that's where this gets tricky.
Yes.
Okay, interesting discussion, and I wonder, my question's been changing as the conversation's progressed, but my name is Anthony Garnham. I work with the Beacon Foundation, and our focus is to address youth unemployment. And we're very busy at the moment, and I'm a bit concerned about some of your comments, Peter, and maybe more aligned with Jill's, because I feel that out there, youth unemployment is a big problem now, and it's getting worse. The direction is very strongly towards worse, and the casualisation of the workforce is part of that. And you mentioned Meyer, there used to be great traineeships there. Now it's casual employment, and then if you do well, part-time. It's a long process, and it's very different to what it was 20 years ago, adding on to your point. I would like to ask the panel generally, is the education system currently, how well is it preparing young people for the world of work as it sits today, as you're describing, and where it's heading? And also, secondly, I believe, and it's a hypothesis, I think we've got to have a major structural reform of our wages, like what happened in New Zealand, down to actually make it work, and I'm interested in your comments on that as well.
Can you just explain what happened in New Zealand? I'm not familiar
with that. So I'm a lay person, but they deregulated the wages so that the unskilled jobs were paid a lot less than what they're paid here in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore they're able to get employment in a much broader way and still make a dollar, because the businesses can't put people on and pay the current wages in Australia. In many instances, that's a barrier for them to hire people.
And so from your point of view, that would be good?
Well, I've got mixed views on that, of course. Mm. But I think, yes, I do think. I do think that would be helpful, even though it's a hard road to go. But I think that's going to happen anyway. There's examples of the accounting firms now and the legal firms outsourcing work directly to China for India for a third of the price. So we know the trend there.
Yep.
So Australia's average wage rate is too high globally, and I feel that for many, many professions, it's got to come down.
Okay.
Well, it's sort of pretty complex in a lot of ways, in the sense that when we think about what's happened over the last 25 years, we've had 25 years largely, close to 23 years of continuous growth, with just one quarter of negative growth over that entire period. So it's an extraordinary story of growth driven largely through the resources boom. That's obviously shifting and changing, but one thing that that process certainly created, or one outcome it created, was, if you like, a wage structure which was driven largely what was happening in that sector. So, you know, they're able to attract people away. Now, increasingly, however, we're seeing these, you know, what I would call these orbits of competition and wage comparison that are being expanded out beyond national borders and becoming more global, partly because of the way that technology, again, is assisting in the offshoring of different types of jobs. So a whole range of legal processes are a good example, again, of that, but it's not just restricted to that. You can think about call centres and the way that they've tended to operate as well, a range of other sort of bits and pieces. So one thing that does come with job creation and destruction is a change in the wage structure. And again, we know that's been changing quite sort of dramatically, partly to accommodate those effects, but it often takes a while to follow. So you do get these problems in the way that adjustment process takes place. So we've got a youth unemployment problem, and I suppose we've got a hidden unemployment problem in the form of underemployment. So if we look at ABS numbers and the proportion of people who say that they would like to work more hours, again, over the last few years, that's been escalating quite dramatically. So as casualisation has happened, part-time work has grown, we've got more and more people in those categories of work that actually don't want to be there. They want to be in full-time, stable, secure employment. It's becoming much...
Which is the opposite, really, of the sorts of the future of employment
that
we're
talking
about, right?
And so when you look at the data around job quality, the sector that's generating the most jobs of high quality, in fact, is the manufacturing sector. So about 80% of jobs in manufacturing, or just over 80%, are full-time jobs with the full array of conditions and benefits that are there. If we look at the retail sector, it's around 50% of jobs fall into that type of category. And around, again, sort of sectors that are generating more jobs, they tend to be of lower quality overall. So it's a real sort of issue.
The university question's a big one, the education one's a big one.
You were asking whether we, you know, what are we doing to train people for the new environment, and it's obviously an issue, and obviously of an enormous concern to most universities, I think, especially those that are essentially vocational universities. And the importance, I think, is to realise that it is changing. It is more difficult for the young at the moment to get work. We're in Victoria affected not just by the technological changes, which are quite huge, and eventually might kill all mass education, mass manufacturing. I mean, there was a fantastic exhibition that we ran in the Design Hub not long ago about the future of work, where perhaps you can manufacture with digital printers in your own backyard.
Well, interestingly, on 7:30 tonight, we've actually got a very interesting story. Not that any of you will make it home in time, but if you would like to iView it, we have a very interesting story on 7:30 coming out tonight about digital printing and what we're going to be able to... to 3D printing, rather, what we're going
to do. So the sort of 20th century workforce, which was a mass... factory workforce, which was organised in unions and had all sorts of other implications, might not exist in the 21st century at the end in any part of the world. It's certainly not going to exist in Australia because there's far cheaper labour forces, as you're saying, overseas. So we can see a lot of things being outsourced and overseas. So what do we do in terms of education? Well, what we're trying to do, and there's a massive amount of thought going into this, it's so critical for our education systems. It's very much educating people to think about it. I don't think we used to have to bother. But now in the first year you think about, you know, have you thought about your career, your future? Is you going to have a career? What are you going to do about it? Second year you engage with industry, you do work education to make sure you have experience, you make sure you're mobile so you get used to environments which are different. Final year, if it's the third year, you make sure you're doing your interviews and you're worrying about jobs. A lot of effort into changing what you do in the classroom and in the curriculum because that's clearly going to be necessary. Also worrying about the skills you're teaching. Clearly in the future, you will have, as you said, portfolio careers. My dad, you know, left school, went to the British Post Office, stayed there for his life. It doesn't exist anymore and it won't in the future. So this flexibility is going to be critically important. And we will see, you know, significant changes. We're a multinational university in many ways. The people overseas get jobs better than the people in Victoria at the moment. Now, that's the future world that you can see. The ones we're teaching overseas will have that. In Victoria, we've got a service industry, which is education. It's quite a good employer, actually. Mm. The jobs aren't bad. Clearly, building and trying to protect that sort of work in Australia is going to be very important as we have to shift from what we do, what we traditionally
and that might
did
change as well
to what we do in it, of course it will. Yeah. So you've got all sorts of flexibilities that have to be thought about and factored into your education systems. And always you'll be a little bit behind the trends, but at least it's being thought about.
You're probably closest to the university experience out of everyone on the panel, Matt. I mean, how well did your university prepare you?
Well, clearly, yeah, very well. No, I'm kidding. I'm not hearing directly my university experience reflected in the sorts of things you guys are saying about university. I mean, my experience of uni was that we didn't get good understanding across disciplines, for example. So there were elements, like I did a whole commerce degree and no one mentioned the word ethics once. Like it should even be a consideration if you're running a business or driving an economy. Yeah.
Don't ask me where you went.
You could do it. It was just an elective. It was optional.
Right.
Same with doing a psychology degree, behavioural science, and not being taught about what this thing called science actually is. So that sort of stepping back and looking at the thing you're doing, what you're going to do in the world and what impact it might have, I didn't see that happening out there in the university that when I did it. It was 10 or 15 years ago now.
Right,
but,
okay,
And I suppose the big change at Melbourne has been the Melbourne model, and it's sort of it's such a big shift in terms of the way that is intended to operate. And I think about sort of undergraduate students. So again, you know, when I sort of went through, which is a little bit before Matt went through, you know, there wasn't a huge amount around the degree extracurricular sort of piece, and I think that was probably true when you were there. But when I look at sort of what opportunities there are for students as undergraduates to do a whole range of things, to you know, work on projects in Africa or other parts of the world, to do international placements, to you know, to work with students in engineering and science around different types of competitions and so forth. I mean, it's the undergraduate experience feels like in the last 5 years in particular, it's just shifted so dramatically. It feels like a very different experience to what it used to be.
What about you, Charles? So I do. Sorry, go on.
I want to, at this point, I think I want to try and shift the discussion a little, because so much of the discussion seems to be there's some sort of inevitability about what's happening and we're stuck with it. And I want to try and shift that a little by coming back to what I said when I introduced myself about the difference between jobs and work. The impression is that there is some sort of uncertainty about the future of jobs. And that may well be true. In fact, there are all sorts of changes taking place. But there's absolutely no uncertainty about the future of work. There always has been more to be done than we have people capable of doing it. You only have to look around your environment, look around your neighbourhood, look around anywhere. There is stuff that needs doing that is not being done. Why is it not being done? Well, the reason it's not being done is because a bunch of people have either overtly or covertly made a decision about what's important and what fits into the economy, and the stuff that fits into the economy gets done because it has money associated with it and all the other things that go with it, and the stuff that doesn't get done is somehow outside the economic system. Now, Matt's experience, and mine to an extent, but he's a perfect example of stuff that 10 years ago, 15 years ago, was outside the economy. It didn't exist in the economy. We've brought it in to the economy. There now are somewhat greenies in residence to some extent. And there are all sorts of other things that have been brought in. This is a matter of choice. So the question, it seems to me, we need to be asking is, what is it we actually want done, and then how do we go about getting it done? Rather than having this view that there's some sort of machine out there which is driving us in some particular direction, and the best we can do is cling on for dear life and hope that our part of it provides us with a sustainable future.
That's a very brave way of putting it, and I just wonder how many average people are really capable of doing that.
Well, the short answer is lots. The examples of universities and university students, it is true, as Matt says, at the time when I went through university, it was Peter, I think, actually said, at the time when we went through university, you didn't spend any time thinking about getting a job at the end of it. In fact, most of the people I went through university with were on studentships or scholarships of some kind. They were paid to be there. Gough just died the other day, but he made a big difference for people at that time, and they didn't even think about it. And finally, when they came out of university, they looked around and there were 10 people standing there saying, please come to me, please come to me. Nowadays, it is true that from the moment you arrive, in fact, long before you get there, the Futures Foundation that I'm chairman of is a membership organisation. We have lots of schools that are members, and they're joining our organisation for exactly this reason. They're worried about it long before the kids get to university, because there is this impression that somehow you've got to navigate your way through it. And the truth is, people are navigating their way through it. They're doing it. Not everybody. The Beacon Foundation is a good example, and in my view, there'll be lots more people falling out the bottom. But there are lots of people who are navigating their way through this uncertain future. Whether it's enough to sustain an economy into the future is another question.
Can I just ask a really quick fire question? Because I think that this is a really key question, is this idea of wage differentiation and whether we need to move more towards that in Australia. And then we'll get to our next question up here from the audience.
Well, when we look comparatively, Australia has one of the most unequal distribution of wages and wealth of any developed country. We're, alongside the United States, we have a highly unequal system. The reality is, and we've got sort of Piketty to thank for this, and his work on inequality has shown that this is a trend that's happened across different countries as well. So inequality is growing. It hasn't solved the problem. It's happened alongside this problem, if you like, of uneven distribution of job opportunities and so on. Mm-hmm. So I'm not convinced, I suppose, that by creating a more unequal wage distribution is necessarily going to solve the
but
problem.
What about more flexibility, for example? You know, I moved back from the UK a couple of years ago, and I found that Australians are extremely well paid. And, for example, here, you know, the classic example of getting paid double time and a half or whatever on a Sunday. In the UK, no one gets that, right? Like the baristas, Monday through Sunday, you're getting the same wage. Do we need to think about more about that? And I don't know if that is the sort of people who... Yeah. Yeah.
And what about all the kids coming out of school who can't get jobs at all? Yeah. I mean, you're focused on the kids who are at Melbourne Uni.
No,
98% of people aren't there.
Yeah.
And there's a lot less chances for them.
So just really quickly from you guys, if I can. Do we need to be more flexible in our wage model?
We're getting this increased inequality because of what we value. We say that the most valuable thing you can do in the world nowadays is to start a business and to accumulate as much of the wealth in that business for yourself as you possibly can. And if you do that, you are incredibly successful, and we value that. And there are an increasing number of people who are doing just that all around the world. And if that's what you value, that's what you get. And for those people who can't do it, either because they're incapable intellectually or physically or whatever, they fall out the bottom. And the mere fact is that while those people are doing that accumulation, there is a fixed volume. It's a huge amount of money. There is a fixed volume of money. So while a lot of it's going that way, a lot of it isn't going the other way. So it's about what we value.
I think I may actually move us on because we've only got 15 minutes left of our discussion. Time really does fly, and I do want to get some more questions from the audience, please.
I think my question echoes the previous question a little. What will disenfranchised and marginalised people, what jobs will they be doing? I've heard a lot of talk about undergraduates, about education. There are people who can't access education. There are people who don't have English as a first language. There are people who aren't interested in education. There are people that aren't interested in having a career. What jobs will they be doing?
Well, I think the fact of the matter is that they're more likely to be doing low-paid, low-skilled jobs, relatively routine jobs, often in personal services.
They could be wiping Charles's bum.
They could be doing Charles's bum, exactly.
There's only room for one of them, I have to tell you. Two is too many.
But it's a very serious question.
Yeah, no, and I think that's the reality, yeah. If you like, of
well, in
of
fact,
the fate
I don't I don't know that I agree with that. I think the answer has to do with, again, thinking differently about the notion of a job. Jobs began around the original concept of the job was this is something that happens in the central business district of a city, so people commute into the job. I'd be saying to these people, and I'd be saying to policymakers, the place to look for what these people are going to do is close to them. There is a whole lot of stuff that needs doing in their own neighbourhood, in their own community. At the moment, we don't look there. John Howard, what's his name? Tony Abbott doesn't know how to look there because he can't see past Canberra. He can't look into local neighbourhoods, so he's making high-level decisions about jobs. I'm interested in saying what needs to be done and how does it get done in local communities in ways that sustain those local communities. Out of that, some things that look like jobs will come, and out of that, some things that look like future jobs will come. But that's where I encourage them to look. Forget Seek. Forget The Age, or there's no ads in The Age anymore. Forget all that. Look close to you.
And for that to work, you actually need to think about the economy rather differently than we do at the moment. So focusing on the wage level and individual incentives, etc., just atomises society. I mean, that's the danger, I think, in the future, that we're going to get a more and more separated society, rich and poor, with a disadvantaged class not looked after. Somehow we've got to start to think about the public policy here and think through how you create an environment and a society where the work is done and somehow the economy supports the need to create that society rather than the society being blown apart for the sake of somebody's idea of an economy. We've got quite a philosophical issue here, I think, and it is actually quite important to try and think it through. It's frightening to think that we'd become more and more atomised and drive the society in a way that really does separate people even more in terms of their life experiences.
Did you have a comment back about that? The lady who questioned in the first place. I was just wondering if you had any comments on that. Just up there. Yeah. Just back there, a couple of rows.
My concern is more about we've traditionally had jobs for disenfranchised and marginalised people, usually in manufacturing, where you could go and work within your ethnic group, speak the language and have a job and have something to do and also have social connection that comes from that. We're losing that social connection for our marginalised people, which makes them even more disenfranchised. How do we manage that? And how do we also impress upon business the importance of social connection through employment?
They're the big questions that you were talking about, very big questions. Okay. Next question. We have one more up there, let's see, I think.
Hi. I don't have so much of a question, but just a couple of comments. Just want to put some ideas out there. So I'm from New Zealand, and I can tell you from first-hand experience and from other New Zealanders that the low wages that we have in New Zealand, say maybe $14 for making coffee as opposed to 20 here, is the reason why a lot of people leave. So, and also, I believe in New Zealand we have about 25% child poverty, growing inequality. So I don't think that cutting wages is a good thing. And then just in terms of what are we going to be teaching in the future at universities or what jobs are going to be there in the future, I don't know exactly where it is at the moment with the political machinations at the moment in Australia, but if universities are deregulated or privatised, respectively, as they have been in the States, then perhaps what's going to be taught is going to be mandated by who it's being funded by, and is that going to be people with money, i.e. corporations? Is that going to be the jobs? And the next point I want to make is, just in terms of disenfranchised people, yes, they should have jobs. So alongside, you know, we celebrate business owners and self-employed, why do not we not educate and supply the funds for worker-owned, worker-managed cooperatives that can exist alongside businesses and give these people some autonomy?
Why do you need to provide funds for that? Why isn't the idea that people...
Why do we need to provide funds for already profitable businesses like coal?
Like
mining.
Coal. Okay.
Billions. Okay. So, just some ideas.
Okay. The university one, can we go to you, Jill, about the university one, if you don't mind?
Sorry, I was just picking up your point about funds for co-ops, which Charles was obviously interested in.
Oh, sorry, go on, Charles, please.
Well, that's what I mean by looking locally. I mean, worker-owned enterprises are another way of operating. There are all sorts of other things that can be done and built locally. But I take the point that someone made about atomising. That's not the way we're being encouraged to think at the moment. We are being encouraged to believe that we are single individuals having to face an increasingly hostile world on our own. And that comes back to Peter's point about marginalised, underutilised people. Those who are struggling to make a living through a bit of part-time work feel like they have to focus so much on that they've got no time to focus on anything else. That's that's the real crux of this question, is how do we get away, what do we need to do to shift our own individual thinking and our collective thinking away from the idea that we're all rapacious individuals that only survive by doing what is best for us individually?
The university deregulation question is obviously a very big one.
It certainly is, yes. It's a big issue, and at the moment we have no idea what's going to get through Senate, although we can probably have a few guesses, so quite what comes out of that. I said earlier that Victoria ought to be proud of its world-class university system. Several universities attract a huge number of overseas students into our educational system. We don't know what's going to happen when it's...
So let's assume that it does happen, as Christopher Pine wants it to happen. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What then about how are the funders of universities going to influence what universities do?
Well, if the subsidy, the government subsidy to university education is cut by 20%, which is what we assume will happen, clearly it's going to be much more expensive to go to universities. What's less clear is how we cope with the people who need scholarships. And many people will need scholarships. I'm like you, Charles. I went to university and to higher education, not only getting the fees paid. In Britain, we got paid to go overseas. Not overseas, we got paid to have residential care as well. Fantastic opportunities. I don't think my generation ever realised how very lucky we were and how short the period was going to be when that occurred.
The question is, point was, though, that there could be corporations coming in to fund universities. Is that one of your points, or have I misunderstood?
Universities will be privatised. That's the point.
Well,
that he
and
made.
I think there's a bigger issue around what.
Sorry, can we just, do you mind, Peter, sure, if we just go back to the question there?
I mean, literally funded by, but no. For example, there's maybe more scope for donations. So we will donate this to you, but there's strings attached, or we expect that this sort of biology gets studied, or this sort of thing gets studied, and then we want first dibs on the patents and blah 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 blah.
Is that going to happen?
Announcement this week or last week, IBM wants to start up a secondary school in Victoria, and the government's saying, what a bloody good idea, go for it, set up a school. Mm. We don't want to run it, you can run it. And IBM is saying, this is what we do in the States, we'll do it here.
It's happening in the vocational sector. Mm. The state government has cut funding because, with education expanding, obviously the taxpayer, it's an issue. The Victorian government cut on vocational education has had a major impact in the way we train the vocational side of higher education, tertiary education, and as a result you've got all around Melbourne, if you look at the cities and the buildings, vast number of private sector institutions now educating at that level.
Well, you're also getting technology beginning to transform the sector and seeing non-university providers come in. So it's fragmenting. So big providers in what was called the MOOCs era, massive online open courses, the Khan Academy, Udacity, they're not universities. They've got people coming out of universities creating them, but they're not universities. They don't offer traditional degrees. Udacity now offers what they call these micro degrees and micro diplomas. They're smaller, more concise things, and they expect that people will continue to accumulate these over their lifetime. Now, Udacity says that they can get somebody through a subject, a single subject, for about $3. So, and it's all because so much is mediated online. Melbourne University is part of a different consortia called Coursera. We've got seven subjects, which is less than 1 year of an undergraduate degree, offered through Coursera across different faculties. There's almost 500,000 students enrolled in those seven subjects on Coursera from all around the world. So it's just a very different model. There's no fee that's paid for those at this point. Udacity's just introduced fees for some of their subjects, but they're much lower than, say, what the university... So I think we're at the beginning of a very disruptive process in the way we deliver education across the board.
Okay. I'm just going to go one more question here.
Just a question for the university representatives. Is industry giving you any steer on where there's skill shortages or where these future, you know, job growth sectors may be? Like, are they saying we need more people who can operate 3D printers or, you know, or even a skill that hasn't been thought of yet or anything like that?
There always have been some communication on all these sort of fronts, and every university, of course, has their advisory committees trying to find out what skills are needed. So it's no different from the past. I think what they've always said and what they're saying even more, perhaps, is that they want social skills, they want flexibility, they want people who are going to shift and change. So I'm not sure that industry is able to cope with this with any greater insight than we are. But there's always been some discussion, of course, about what skills are needed. Would you agree?
So, well, the ABS does projections in terms of industries, where jobs are coming from in terms of industries, occupations. I think the best projections come through the US Bureau of Labor Statistics. And there's, I suppose, broadly predicting some key categories which will emerge as the big growth areas for jobs. The first around technical skills and mathematical skills. Hal Varian, who's the head econometrician at Google and a former professor, sort of says the sexiest job in the 21st century is the statistician. So there's a big lot of jobs sort of emerging there around personal care. So again, the US Labor Bureau of Labor Statistics predicts that will be a huge growth area. And the sort of work that Matt is in, that category of jobs, is also predicted to be a very important engine of jobs growth. So we've got some idea based on projections, but these come with very large sort of margins for error. So I think we get a bit of an idea, but I wouldn't sort of bet your bottom dollar, if you like, on those projections coming true.
So I've got a question. As I said earlier, I've got a three-year-old daughter. What jobs is she going to be doing in her lifetime?
Well,
probably won't be journalism.
No, it certainly won't be journalism. That's right.
I have to say I'm probably personally less interested in what the jobs of the future will be as what the jobs in the future will be for. Mm-hmm. I think we need work and economies and university degrees that serve us rather than serving, I think as Charles referenced before, some you could refer to as a growth machine or, this economy that we've created for ourselves that doesn't necessarily serve our needs. It's actually starting to make us less healthy, less happy, and less long-term sustainable into the future as well. So I think that your daughter will be working in a role that is for more community, more collaboration, more positive outcomes, and trying to solve the mess that her parents' generation and the parents' generation before that have created.
Okay. Peter?
Well, I think there are probably many different futures for her, and in fact probably over the course of her lifetime she might dip in and out of paid employment more frequently and perhaps sort of engage in a broader range of different things, or she might find some abrupt shifts in the sorts of work that she does, and which require then going back, retraining and doing some very different things. So it could be in any number of areas. They could be, if you like, sort of well paid. They might not be well paid at all. I think it depends, not necessarily just on her choices, but on a whole range of forces that are beyond her control.
Mm. I'd go back to something someone said earlier about the promise of technology in the 1970s and 80s was that we'd all have more leisure time. Those who were around at that time clearly remember that. Mm. So a question to ask is, why don't we have more leisure time? We clearly could if we wanted to. Why don't we? And so the advice I'd be giving your three-year-old is the reason we haven't got more... A major reason we haven't got more leisure time is all the fragility and contingent nature of work that we're currently confronted with. That's a very powerful reason. But a second reason is we don't know what to do with ourselves anymore. We don't know how to fill our time. Why are all these people playing these mindless games on the train on their way in? What did we used to do before they existed? I don't know. So the advice I'd be giving your three-year-old is forget about a job. I don't want her to ever have a job, personally. But to ask herself the question, what makes her life meaningful? Go back to Matt's comment. Matt made the comment at a more global level, but at her personal level, what makes her life interesting? Mm. What motivates her? What gets her going? What does she like doing? What are the people around her doing? And then to say, okay, now that I've worked that out, how do I do that in such a way that I'm sustained by it? That's the big shift in the last 50 years. You couldn't do that 50 years ago. You had to go to Maya. It was the only place to go. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, there are an incredibly wide variety of places to go. We're shrinking them down and we're not doing a particularly good job, and as Matt says, we're destroying the planet and our health and environment and all that sort of stuff. But if we think about it differently, there are still plenty of places to go and plenty of ways to make life meaningful. And to give me a chance to say something that hasn't come up yet, it's got nothing to do with a shortage of money, folks. There's plenty of money around. It's how we're shifting the money around. So she doesn't have to worry about there being a shortage of money. The banks are making a very good job of making sure there's plenty of money around. She's just got to ask, how am I going to get some of it to sustain myself?
Mm. And I was going to add to that, yeah. It does seem to me that there'll be plenty of opportunities to think about what to do. The question is, how do you actually, in an environment where the employer isn't necessarily going to be as reliable as previously in providing the standard long-term jobs, how do we teach people, and this is a university challenge, how do we teach people to think how they will get the money to do what they want? Mm. And that means we are pouring ideas into business planning competitions, entrepreneurship courses, anything that gets students thinking, perhaps with a group of mates, how would you set something up and get the money that enables you to do what you want. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of future thinking and responsibility for yourself that you're going to have to do. And it involves thinking a different way about the economy, but it's a big challenge. But that's clearly what we're going to have to teach.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you very much. It's been a fascinating conversation. We could go on for hours, couldn't we, about all of this stuff. Molly Meldrum's due, so we need to vacate the hall. But thank you very much for coming. And there is going to be one more of these question time sessions next month here at Wheeler Centre. It would be great if you all came along. And in the meantime, if you could join me in thanking our fantastic panel tonight, Matt Wicking, Jill Palmer, Charles Grass, and Peter Gahan.